called to be mighty for God? Well, it's actually very close to what we're talking about in our morning services about Simon Peter. Simon Peter was called to be mighty for God. And I think he could sing that song we just sang. You know, he saw the wretchedness of his state when he realized he just couldn't do it himself. But that doesn't mean that God didn't want him to be mighty. God's purpose for us is to be mighty. And the passage we're reading tonight in 2 Samuel 23 comes immediately after David has just told us his last words. Well, we read on in the next few chapters of him doing some things that weren't very good, actually. These are the last words of wisdom that he gives us. We heard them last week. The oracle of David, the son of Jesse, the oracle of a man who was raised on high, the anointed of the God of Jacob. David realized that he had been anointed by God. God had chosen him and called him. The Spirit of the Lord speaks by me, he says. He's confident that God is speaking through him. His word is on my tongue. And he says, the God of Israel has spoken, the Rock of Israel has said, when one rules justly over men, ruling in the fear of God, he dawns on them like the morning light. It's like David is looking over his whole life and reflecting on when the blessing of God was released through him as the anointed one. Because clearly it wasn't all the time. Certainly the sin of Bathsheba, the death of Uriah, all of that was a terrible time. And then we've got all the troubles that come through his sons and the consequences of his sin. There was injustice. There was a lack of fear of God. But he's reflecting on his own life. And it is so easy to fall as David did. And yet, God restores David. As we know, we've looked at that in Psalm 51, where he confesses and acknowledges what he's done that is wrong. But David didn't do this alone. And none of us do it alone. Tonight, if you look at your life, if you consider how God has used others who love him to impact you personally, you will be like David. David is recounting all these mighty men of God who actually enabled him to fulfill what he was called to do. When we fail to see that there are others around us that God has chosen to be instruments of our strengthening, of our equipping, of our enabling to do the task, unless we see this, well, we will fail to see what God is really doing. And we will become proud, we'll become, you know, self-righteous, thinking we've done it ourselves. You know, Frank Sinatra, I did it my way. David is acknowledging the mighty men of God who were with him. And did you notice the last name he mentions? Uriah the Hittite. It's like he reaches a climax at this point. Uriah the Hittite is like standing out above all these 37 or 36 others. Who was Uriah the Hittite? The husband of Bathsheba? Here is David acknowledging, in the face of his own sinfulness, the one he put out in the front of the battle, and he got killed so that he could somehow clear himself and embrace Bathsheba as his wife. 37 mighty men are named. And thank you, by the way, Michael, you did a great job reading those names. I'm sorry that you were landed with that responsibility. Uriah the Hittite, what an amazing climax to bring, the final person. These men were so dedicated to God, all of them, they were dedicated to God. And they were dedicated to David. They fought for him. What happens in the story of Uriah? Well, we know the story. We've looked at it because we were in this passage as David is described here. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained at Jerusalem. David didn't fight. David didn't stand. He remained siestering. It happened late one afternoon when David arose from his couch and was walking on the roof of the king's house. He saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. And David sent inquired about the woman, and one said, "Is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" So David sent messengers and took her. You know, just imagine. Messengers come and tell you, this is the wife of one of your mighty men. He's gone out to battle to fight for you. This kind of really pictures who David's state right now. How utterly contemptible is this behavior? And how does he fall into it? By choosing not to be in the battle. And we can all do this. So David sent message, took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she had been purifying herself from her uncleanness. Then she returned to her house, and the woman conceived, and she sent to David and told him, "I am pregnant." Well, today they'd just say, "Have an abortion." That'd be the solution, wouldn't it? Is that any less severe than what David does? So David sent word to Joab, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." And Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked how Joab was doing and how the people were doing and how the war was going. Then David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house, wash your feet." And Uriah went out of the king's house, and there followed him a present from the king. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord, did not go down to his house. Why did he do that? You know, in the scriptures, God talks about to his people not to enter into sexual relations when you're in battle. Not to indulge the flesh, not to satisfy the desires of the flesh, but to focus on the battle. This is a man focused on the battle. He is not going to just yield to the desires of his flesh. So he doesn't go even to his own wife. When they told David, Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, "Have you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house?" Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah dwell in booths. My lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go down to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing." He is so focused on what is needed to be done, fighting the battle. And David said to Uriah, "Remain here today also, and tomorrow I will send you back." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. And David invited him, and he ate in his presence and drank, so that he made him drunk. And in the evening he went out to lie on his couch with the servants of his lord. but he did not go down to his house. David is desperate to get him to go down to his house, isn't he? He's trying to force him into fleshly behavior. He's even making him drunk. But what does the flesh do? It wars against the spirit. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. In the letter, he wrote, "Set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting and then draw back from him that he may be struck down and die." Here is a mighty man of God being thrust into the battle to be killed. And who is culpable for this? The man after God's own heart? What? As Job was besieging the city, he assigned Uriah to the place where he knew that there were valiant men. And the men of the city came out and fought with Job. Some of the servants of David among the people fell. Uriah the Hittite also died. Then Job sent and told David all the news about the fighting. He instructed the messenger, "When you have finished telling all the news about the fighting to the king, then if the king's anger rises, and if he says to you, 'Why did you go so near the city to fight? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who killed Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal? Did not a woman cast an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died too at Thebes? Why did you go to so near the wall? Then you shall say, 'Your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead.'" That'll satisfy him. That'll turn him away from thinking we'd acted foolishly. How deeply convicted was David when he realized what he had done? When he names his 37 mighty men and ends with Uriah the Hittite. Well, there is a desperate need today for mighty men. I spent some time this last week thinking I was going to the theological college just to test the waters in the Presbyterian Church and meeting mighty men of God. Mighty men who are ready to fight the battle, who are ready to stand in the midst of all that is taking place in our world. And they strengthened me greatly. One of them suggested that I purchase a book called Five Lies of Our Anti-Christian Age by Rosaria Butterfield. You're going to hear a lot more from this book. Rosaria Butterfield, do you know who she is? Mrs. Butterfield attended predominantly liberal Catholic schools. She's most widely known today for her autobiography, The Secret Thoughts of an Unlikely Convert, an English professor's journey into the Christian faith, in which she details her transformation from a postmodernist to a Bible-believing Christian. For nearly a decade, she lived as an openly lesbian activist while researching the religious right and their politics of hatred against the queer community. She wrote an article criticizing the evangelical organization Promise Keepers. You know, Promise Keepers were set up to strengthen men to be mighty men of God. The very thing that is needed today, mighty men of God. She wrote against it. Ken Smith, the then pastor of Syracuse Reformed Presbyterian Church, wrote to her regarding this article and invited her to dinner. There's a good thing to do. Have your enemies for dinner. Her subsequent friendship with the Smiths led to her reevaluation of her presuppositions. 2 years later, Butterfield converted to evangelical Christianity. Following her conversion, she developed a ministry to college students. She now frequently speaks at churches, universities about her experience. And she has written this marvelous book. And her preface says this: "This book is for Christians, especially Christian women who aren't ashamed of the Bible and its teachings, or who are and want to change. Who want to change. Young married women, my hope is that this book will encourage you to press on in holy faith and living. For young single women, I hope that you will aspire to be faithful and fruitful Christian wives. That is, to be helpers. Wives counts devoted homemakers to a godly man, raising children to the glory of God. For older single and married women, my hope is that you will take up your role of honour as spiritual mothers to young women in the church. This lady has written some radical stuff. Simon Manchester, who encouraged me to purchase this book, and very kindly, when I went to buy it, paid for 2/3 of it himself. He's a retired Anglican minister in Sydney. He said this book cut right through him. No compromises. Our world has completely disfigured the role of men and women. And this lady is seeking to bring a biblical perspective to draw men and women back to their true position before God. And she points out, we need mighty men of valor. Men who will have wives who will stand alongside them and be true helpers to them as God intended. Today we are living in desperate times for mighty men of valor. We found this beautiful devotion, which is in your service sheet. You can follow with me as I read it to you, because I think this is very telling. When David Livingstone, the missionary pioneer, was working in Africa, some friends wrote, "We would like to send other men to you. Have you found a good road into your area yet?" Livingstone wrote back, "If you have men who will only come if they know there is a good road, I don't want them. I don't want them. I want men who will come if there's no road at all." By way of contrast, a cartoon in Leadership, summer 1988, poked fun at the low level of commitment required in many modern churches. It pictured a church building with a sign in front which read, "The Light Church, 24% fewer commitments, home of the 7.5% tithe, 15-minute sermons, 45-minute worship services. We have only 8 commandments, your choice. We use just 3 spiritual laws and have an 800-year millennium. Everything you wanted in a church and less." It's so easy for us to sort of look at this and think, oh, that's ridiculous. But perhaps the cartoon is written because there's evidence of these very things in the church. As one pastor put it, 90% of our parishes across the country require less commitment than the local Kiwanis Club. Down through the ages, whenever God has done a significant work, he has done it through a band of committed people. God doesn't work through the lukewarm, but only through those who are fervent in their love for Christ and his kingdom. This was the case when David's kingdom was established. Through David's reign, the name of the Lord God of Israel was published far and abroad. But great as he was, David did not stand alone. Surrounding him were a band of mighty men who accomplished great feats of valor. They were committed to David and his kingdom. We read of them in 2 Samuel 23. If God is going to accomplish a great work among us, then he wants to raise up a band of mighty men in our midst who can do great exploits for God. In saying mighty men, I am not excluding mighty women, but I am emphasizing the need for strong men of faith. While the Bible teaches the equality of the sexes in personhood and in standing before God, it also teaches that God has ordained different roles for the sexes. The New Testament makes it clear that God desires men to be in spiritual leadership in the home and church, the church today, and he's talking about his church, this church, needs a band of mighty men like these who surrounded David. And perhaps the pinnacle of these mighty men is Uriah the Hittite. For he is a type of Jesus Christ. He faced the battle when everybody withdrew. Everybody. You included. Yes. You included. And he was killed because of our sin. He is the one that we look to equip us to be like Uriah. He can enable each one of us to be mighty men of valor. Let us pray.